Welcome to the Tall Poppies podcast. To find out more about our guests or the content of the program, including information about the musical excerpts, visit our website at tall-poppies.com. Hello, Brendan O'Shea here, welcoming you to another episode of Tall Poppies, the podcast. It's been a busy few months for the Tall Poppies project. A few days back, we hosted the fifth Tall Poppies Talk, a salon held every few months at a wonderful and intimate space in Berlin. As always, an enthusiastic audience packed the venue to hear and interact with our guest of honour, who was this time Sydney-born neuroscientist and violinist Matthew Larkham. Keep an ear out for my podcast featuring this extraordinary Australian coming up soon. Once again, special thanks to the podcast sponsors. Your financial contributions make it possible for this project to continue. For those of you who might be considering sponsoring the podcast and thereby allowing me to continue my research, interviewing and production of this living archive, do drop by the Tall Poppies website. You find it at tall-poppies.com. And here's the direct link to the Patreon page, which makes donating to this project easy. patreon.com/tallpoppiestalk. patreon.com/tallpoppiestalk. And Tall Poppies Talk is written together as one word. I give that to you again. patreon.com/tallpoppiestalk. And don't forget our podcast archives, which feature in-depth interviews with many phenomenal Australian luminaries, including the author Gail Jones, theatre director Barry Kosky, and philosopher Peter Singer. But now, let me introduce you to this episode's guest.
Around about that time, if you were to walk past our place or come visit us, you know, we get home from school at 4, there might have been something to eat 5, and I think it was around about between 5 and 8 at any given time, there were probably 4 of us practicing in 4 rooms. I mean, it would have sounded like a conservatorium, and all violins, so, you know, when everyone's, I won't use the word screeching, but when everyone's playing around in those high registers all at the same time, I know it's a good thing that everybody in Australia has their own house, I think, because I don't think you'd find a flat here in the city with neighbours above and below that would put up with that sort of noise.
That's Stanley Dodds, an extraordinary musician and a violinist with the renowned Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra since the early 90s. Stan is also a conductor and frequently directs ensembles of the Berlin Philharmonic and was appointed principal conductor of the Berlin Symphony Orchestra in 2014. Other guest conductor appearances include engagements with the Orchestra Philharmonique in Luxembourg, Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, the Berlin Sharon Ensemble, and the Australian World Orchestra.
I think if I look back on my life, how it started with violin and it went to string ensemble and now it's landed with the orchestra and it's settled very, very firmly in the orchestra environment, I think I could safely say that I live now for orchestras.
Stan is dedicated to working with youth and amateur orchestras and is in charge of the Berlin Philharmonic School's Orchestra Concert and Youth Composition Workshop. Indeed, he is also a member of the Berlin Philharmonic Executive Board, where his management portfolios include media rights and the development of digital streaming and communications platforms. But Stan's career in music started back in Adelaide, where he was one of five siblings, four of whom have become professional violinists. Stan was born in Canada, but shortly after his birth, his parents moved to Australia. His mum is Chinese, and his dad was originally from Armidale in New South Wales. They were both mathematicians and had met in Canada. At just 4 years of age, Stan started violin lessons with Mrs. Larsons, an Adelaide music teacher who ran a studio that became the breeding ground for many outstanding musicians. Three of these were indeed Stan's siblings. When his father took a sabbatical to Austria, the family accompanied him and Stan attended the Musikgymnasium in Linz. This was an important time for the young musician, who later returned to study at the Lucerne Conservatory and then at the Carillon Academy in Berlin, before joining the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra in 1994. Since that time, Stan has also studied conducting, where his mentors include Claudio Abbado and Sir Simon Rattle. Stan has made his home in Berlin, where together with his wife, the cellist Rowena Spirit Dodds from Queensland, he has three grown-up children. He was recently our guest of honour at the Tall Poppies Talk Salon in Berlin, and I caught up with him in between his busy schedule. Stan Dodds, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Here we are in Berlin. You've been here a little bit longer than me, 1994 when you first came. How's your sort of relationship with this city changed over those years? I mean, it was quite an interesting time to arrive, 4 years after the fall of the wall.
It wasn't love at first sight, I have to admit. I mean, I was fascinated by the city. The first time I visited was actually around 1990-91. Was only a few months even after the wall had come down, and it consisted mostly of a tour throughout the night in various suburbs of Berlin at a New Year's Eve, various New Year's Eve parties. And I was struck how there is so much going on behind the scenes in this town and so many different circles of people. And I found that fascinating. But when I actually moved here, I came from, or had been living for 5 years in the very idyllic Swiss mountain, little bigger than a village, but still it's a small town, Lucerne, on the banks of a wonderful lake and surrounded by mountains. And so I had become a little bit accustomed to this postcard perfectness. And when you come to Berlin from such a physically beautiful place, you are struck by how run down some places seem, how you seem to get grandeur juxtaposed with dereliction. You get magnificent buildings side by side with post-war 50s, 60s, fast constructed functional buildings. And the general impression is certainly not one of coherence. And it just seems to be a little bit chaotic, a little bit hard-nosed, for sure. I mean, that's the famous character of the Berliner, is one who just gives it straight back to you hard as nails. Yeah, the so-called schnauzer. But interestingly, actually, over time, I grew to appreciate exactly that side of Berlin as something else. Namely, I began to see it as maybe some of them are definitely scars from its history. It has an incredibly lively history in the last, particularly the last 150 years or 100 years. And somehow when you drive around the city, it's like looking at a wonderful being where you see many, many signs of the tumultuous life that it has had. And thus I began to see Berlin more as a living thing rather than a statically beautiful object to admire. It is a very human place in that it's been the site of great human tribulation, suffering, but also unbelievable cutting-edge thought and work in the arts, in the sciences. I mean, I am always fascinated by those pictures from like Berlin in the 10s and 20s when you have someone like Albert Einstein sitting in a room not unlike a room in which I live with his violin playing together with some other professors, professed music addict. And that was probably happening, a little more than a stone's throw from where I'm living. And so to live amongst these types of stories, I mean, I by the same token, you have to also think, you know, what was happening here in the 30s and 40s. There are memories of that here on the streets. When you walk around the suburbs, you see these little brass ingots in the sidewalks, reminding you of Jewish families that were forcibly removed from these same houses and taken away, often to their death. The whole history of then the wall and all of the attempts to try and override that human need for freedom of spirit by enclosing it all in some ideological capsule, and then how that broke down. I mean, no matter where you turn, you see a different facet of our existence in a way. And I think what I grew to be really attached to is this multifaceted side to Berlin, where you can see the scars, but also the beautiful side to that as well, everywhere you walk.
What about that remarkable institution of which you are a member, the Berlin Philharmonic? Can you sense within it also some of those scars, some of those various aspects of history over the years?
Perhaps a little less than the way the city presents itself to you. I mean, the city is full of icons which represent very directly certain periods. I mean, you know, you take the Tempelhof Airport. I mean, that is a gigantic piece of Albert Speer and Hitler city planning. I wouldn't say that we in the orchestra are confronted with that sort of thing in that direct way. I mean, every now and again you might get a piece of music put in front of you where it says, yes, this did belong to the Reichsrundfunkanstalt, but this is really rare because, I mean, in the end, we're a contemporary orchestra and we play from modern materials. You're more likely to encounter that perhaps in some other circles. But there's no denying that although this orchestra sees itself as a progressive orchestra in terms of that we've always been interested in, for example, the cutting edge of media, recordings, you know, being one of the orchestras that pioneered the CD, for example, pioneering streaming with our digital concert hall. So on some level, we see ourselves as very progressive. We chose Simon Rattle as our chief conductor on particularly that on that wave of, you know, where is an orchestra headed in the 21st century. But nevertheless, by the same token, we're very, very conscious of our tradition. And the tradition being commencing in the 1880s with Bülow, and of course a very important chapter then before and during the war with Furtwängler. And all of the problematic approach to the person of Furtwängler that is associated with it. It's not something we talk about every day, but I mean, I often think that the way we approach certain repertoire, even the way we regard certain repertoire as a core of our existence, is probably still a relic from those days when people like Furtwängler, and then perhaps followed up by Karajan, made it so. Even Karajan himself, he had a history also with the Nazi party. So this is certainly a part of the orchestra, but as it is probably a part of anybody with the German history who's been in this country in the last 100 years. And it's no more, no less than others. I think the orchestra did benefit in some ways also from the Nazi policies here. I mean, there were some great culture lovers amongst the Nazi leadership, and you know, you can't choose the people who are your greatest fans. They love music, and so there was sometimes a bit of a fight to see who could support the Berlin music institutions more. And it was actually the period when our orchestra went from being a freelance orchestra on the brink of existential extinction, simply because, you know, with the gigs coming or not, to being actually a government or a state-funded institution. That actually occurred in the 30s and 40s. And so there you go. That's our very structure, institutional structure that we have today, has a certain history going back to that time, as, for example, do the Autobahns in Germany. Mm. You know, there's when you live here, you have to find a way of reconciling yourself with the fact that there is a bright and a dark side to everything, and that sort of the two of them together comprise life.
Thank you.
Let's jump back a bit, though.
Yeah.
You're the son of two mathematicians. You've been kind enough to be a guest in our salon here in Berlin. We've already talked about lots of this. And for your parents, it was very important that, you know, you got a musical education and things. What sort of relationship did they have with music that led them to think, okay, we're going to make sure that our family all learn an instrument in a particular way?
I think, my parents came, both of them, from very different backgrounds. My mother was from China and grew up in Taiwan before going to the US to study. My father was from Armidale in Australia, so a university town. I think that my mother had some musical education as part of her general education as it was offered. I think there was some basic piano instruction. I think that was basically considered as in just one of the other subjects in that palette of subjects that one studies at school. It wasn't a dedicated or focused musical education, but there was something there. Even, many decades later, she could still sing songs that she'd learnt. Interestingly, very often familiar Western children's songs, but with a Chinese text. Some they could even be opera arias or something. So they were somehow onto a lot of Western culture through music, but adapted to their specific educational needs at the time. For my father, the way I understood it was growing up in Armidale, for him as a young boy, what took up his time outside of school and work was actually sports, and not to mention just getting outdoors. I think there was a certain amount of being outdoors, doing outdoor things, but certainly things like rugby and cricket were the main focus. And if I understand correctly, he wasn't really confronted with classical music until he was maybe 17 or 18 years old. He can remember isolated contact with, I think, visiting orchestras. Could even be the Sydney Symphony came and did an outreach concert. That may or may not have been the case. But he can remember very distinctly the first time he sat down and someone put on a record and he listened to it and thought, this is really beautiful. And it was Beethoven Violin Concerto with Wolfgang Schneiderhan.
What good taste.
Well, he was lucky. Yeah, it seems like I think he did have the good fortune to be around some people who did know a thing or two. And I'd say what happened was, it in his case, it awakened a fascination. And I know that when he, at various stages then during his studies, he actually tried to find out more about it, but usually on a autodidactic level. So he bought a recorder, bought a book, and tried to figure out how to play it. And so I think there was this a deep fascination for the idiom. Yeah, and I think he also grew up, though, believing that music was an important thing for kids to learn. It was a good thing for them. And so I think that was something my parents concurred with agreed on immediately. And then sort of when that came to be that they had kids of their own and they heard about a good teacher nearby, well, that seemed to be just simply the right thing to do. And as it was, the teacher was very, very serious about it, and it was much more than just a sort of a casual once-a-week thing. It actually became all-encompassing, and to the extent where it influenced any sporting ambitions I might have had, because suddenly your fingers mattered, so that meant basketball didn't work and Aussie rules football didn't work and cricket was absolutely off-limits. So I was just left with athletics. That was all I could do.
That's sort of unusual for an Australian because, I mean, you know, an Australian upbringing, you know, we're pushed outside. That cricket bat is forced into our hands, or we're out playing footy almost before we're out of nappies.
Well, I mean, we still play backyard cricket, but we never play with a cricket ball. We play with a tennis ball. And yes, of course, I kicked the Aussie rules football around and could do a decent drop punt and screwy. But the thing was, I couldn't join the teams because it was sort of considered if I did it too much, it was. And I don't think I fought it actually. I wasn't, because it was the thing, I had enough challenges and was enjoying what I was doing. And I could get away with my very basic ball skills on the playground so that I didn't have to sit in the corner and only, I don't know, whatever it would be. Back then you couldn't listen to stuff. But
yeah, Stan Dodge, you're better than me because I couldn't. I was so hopeless at all of this. But anyhow, I think that's wonderful. Tell us about, though, these first lessons, because we've established already that this is quite a remarkable teacher. She has been responsible for turning out many wonderful string players over the years. Her name was Mrs. Larsons, right?
Well, it was actually a friend's daughter was learning there. That was the connection. And it was about 4 or 5 kilometres from our place, so very easy drivable distance. And then, of course, it was, I believe she auditioned all prospective students by inviting them around, and the first thing you would do was just sing a few notes at the piano, because she placed a great emphasis on oral training. And based on that, I think she would make up her mind whether there was a basic aptitude or not. I mean, exactly how that hour was, all I know is that she did also place a great emphasis on the parents supervising, particularly small kids. So she demanded a large commitment also from my parents, which my parents, I think, because they were interested in music, and this became, in a way, a chance for that musical education they never got themselves but were so curious about. So indeed, my father and my mother sat with all of us, and we were four of us at one stage, for, I'd say, a good 6-7 years, and I mean every day practice. So it started off at the piano, we would sing, and then you play your scales and pieces, and of course when there were several of us playing, it meant that they would walk between the rooms, but they were certainly important co-tutors in that respect. You know, they would be at the lesson, they would write down what it was, and they were very involved, and I think I have a lot to thank them for that, because that is, there is a certain age from which, of course, you have to encourage kids to become independent, to work for themselves, to see the value, and to structure the way they work so that they can progress. But there's no doubt that at the beginning you need adult supervision for the small kids. Mm. And then you've got to find the right measure too.
Both your mum and dad?
Both of them took part in it. Mm. I mean, at some point they sort of split up a little bit, and I think it was a little bit dad did the boys and mum did the girls. But I think it was all whoever was there and available.
Tell us about those lessons. You mentioned already, of course, solfège, in other words, singing right from the very beginning. And this particular teacher had a very specific way of doing it. And we learned along the way that she actually wasn't a string player herself, but a very good pianist. And there was a lot of work already right from very early on, working with the violin and the piano all the time. She must have been quite convincing in many ways. You know, your parents have decided to basically follow through with four of you with the same teacher over those years.
You know, it's a really long time ago, and it's hard to say exactly how it was. I mean, I remember a tall, strict, but nevertheless with a certain softness. And she was someone you wanted to please, demanding. I mean, it was clear what we had to do. And a very specific part of the entire musical training was singing. It was singing with the solfège. If you got a new piece, for example, you had to first, before you were allowed to play it, you first had to sing it and with the note name. So I think, I mean, that I understand now why that's so important, because if you can hear a piece, it's much easier to find it on the instrument than if you can't hear it yet and have to find it on the instrument. But she was, without doubt, a very authoritative figure. I don't remember her being loud or abrasive. I remember wanting to please her. I think that's a very important part of any student-teacher relationship, actually, is that you want to please. And then after a few years, it just actually it just becomes what you do. Mm. You don't even really think about it that much anymore. But I have. Good memories. I have no traumatic memories of that time whatsoever, really.
She placed a lot of emphasis on ensemble playing also from the beginning too, didn't she?
Well, the ensemble was a bit special because it was only violins. And so it was a violin ensemble. There would be at most two violin parts. She would sit down at the piano. We would go every Saturday morning and we would have a list of repertoire and we had to play it by heart. That was the other thing. We had to play everything by heart. Had to be learned from memory, including these ensemble pieces. And so memory training was also a very important part of the musical education. And when you sat there in the group, you had to know your part. And she would say then, by next week, everybody has to have this piece by heart. And so that way she developed, this was called Silver Strings Ensemble, she developed a repertoire, and this ensemble would go and play two concerts a year in Adelaide. But there were a couple of highlights as a kid. I can still remember very distinctly when we were asked to play at a surprise birthday party for the governor of South Australia, which meant being smuggled into Government House. And back then it was the 70s, you know, so the boys were wearing velvet tuxes with vests that our mothers had all made, and the girls had these flashy dresses with sort of peacock feathers or something all around. Really cute when you look back at the pictures. And we were smuggled in and then taken into this room full of gold, and I remember being very impressed with the aide-de-camp because he had this gold braid over his left shoulder. And anyway, so the doors opened. We did this surprise birthday party for him and played our little numbers, and he was absolutely delighted. And then we all went home and tried to make the gold braid out of the nearest skipping rope we could find because we were so fascinated by this.
Oh, that's a nice story. What about Mrs. Larsens? What did you find out about her? She's where she was from, her background and things like that. Did that reveal itself over the years? I mean, you know now, of course, and you can maybe share that with us again.
Yeah, I have to admit, ashamedly, I don't know very many specifics about her background. I know that there is a side to her story of fleeing Europe. She was a refugee of some kind. She had a tattooed number on her forearm, I seem to remember. Okay. But what exactly this means, that would be a whole nother story, and I would be extremely fascinated to know more about it. Mm. I mean, from whom they escaped and under which conditions. I know it was via Western Europe. There was something about Belgium. It was about the time her children were born. But I feel like I'm completely the wrong person to even begin to surmise about what the actual story is. But obviously grateful refugees to Australia at that time.
And she was from Latvia, and Latvia has in the last years turned out many great musicians, hasn't it?
Indeed it has. I am often struck by the fact how for a small country, there are so many world-class musicians, conductors, soloists, as part of our musical business.
Indeed. Indeed. Five kids, but four of you were violinists. And there was that year when you were 15, your dad had a sabbatical and you came to Europe, your first connection with Europe. And all of a sudden, that relationship with music changed quite a bit, didn't it?
It did, because for the first time, I was put into a school environment where music was the central focus for everybody who was at that school, because it was a special music school. So all of those who were passionate about music and who were studying music at the conservatorium were at that school. And it was a school with a long history as well, with some very successful alumni amongst them Franz Welser-Möst, who had just graduated the year before we arrived. So okay. The school was still on a high from the work he'd done as in some of his first years as conductor, actually.
You must mention that he is a very famous conductor these days.
Exactly. So this was the environment that we came into, and suddenly playing violin was something that could be integrated and into our school life. And any musical talent that we had was seen as a valuable asset in, let's say, the normal everyday environment. I was used to keeping the environments somewhat separate. There would be a school environment, there would be a music environment, and I kept them distinct in Australia. It was a little bit the nature, perhaps, of the way I was trained in Australia and the nature of the studio at which I study. I'm not saying it has to be like that, not at all. It was just the way that happened for me. But in Austria, that those two sides really came together. And I mean, there were various experiences. There were, and not all of them necessarily of the highest sort of quality. We played a lot of solo with a small orchestra in little villages around Linz. I took part in at New Year's and at Carnival when the school orchestra gets together and just more or less sight reads Vienna waltzes all night, you know, much like what we hear the Vienna Philharmonic do. But they do this as just part of their normal tradition. I mean, these were the sorts of experiences where you saw how what people did as music, or going on, for example, on Sunday and playing a mass in a Baroque church with one rehearsal and getting paid some more than I was used to seeing, and then going out and buying myself some nice clothes. I mean, yeah, you could say I was spoiled. Music moved away from just something I did for pleasure and ideal reasons, and then suddenly became, there was the prospect that this could be a livelihood even. Mm. All these things were new experiences for me.
With music moving into the same sort of category as the academic work, did you find that it maybe influenced it a little? Did it help it in any way?
Not really. I think what was new for me, though, is that I had music subjects at school, and I had a music professor who I think had an appreciation for all things to do with learning, of which now music was a part. I think it simply enriched the school environment because you had more variety, actually. I think that's what's nice about it. It's a bit like the way, you know, your sport lessons at school mix it up. Well, the thing is, it doesn't need to be just sport and academic. You can have sport and music and academic, and that's three different ways. Or, I mean, I loved high school when, you know, you got to that stage where you would be doing things like cooking and metalwork and photography and then maths and then sports. I mean, I think there's one thing that I've always appreciated, and that's variety, because I think my interests are very restless and go in many directions.
What about time to practice, though?
Well, that was a good thing about the school. It was structured so that the students of that school took an extra year to do their finishing certificate, and the time that that freed up on every school day was then reserved for practice. In other words, school finished an hour, 2 hours earlier than all the other schools in Austria.
Oh, wow.
Each day, so that you would have that time for lessons and to practice.
Yeah, right. Well, that's quite something, quite a special place. You went back to Australia, wasn't going to be for long. You finished your matriculation there in Adelaide, and then it was coming back to Europe again. By this stage, you already had three other siblings that were playing as well. What was that like as a musician? Did you discuss violin playing? And I mean, was there a lot of chamber music together? I mean, there's not much around for four strings. Of course, if your parents were mathematicians, perhaps if they'd thought about it, they might have had a cellist, a viola player, and another violinist, and we could have a quartet or something. But, you know, what was life like in the musical aspect of the Dodds family?
Well, if I remember rightly, around about that time, if you were to walk past our place or come visit us, you know, we get home from school at 4, there might have been something to eat, 5. And I think it was around about between 5 and 8 at any given time, there were probably 4 of us practicing in 4 rooms. I mean, it would have sounded like a conservatorium. And all violins, so, you know, when everyone's, I won't use the word screeching, but when everyone's playing around in those high registers all at the same time, I know it's a good thing that everybody in Australia has their own house, I think, because I don't think you'd find a flat here in the city with neighbours above and below that would put up with that sort of noise.
Indeed. You came back, and of course then the son of Mrs. Larsons then came to be your teacher again, so you followed it on. What was it like coming back? You already, by that stage, had done a little bit more German. You had established yourself in that respect. And then to join the tertiary education aspect of Europe.
When I went back to Australia after the year in Austria, I already knew I was coming back and I knew where I was going. So it was almost as if the year in Australia was spent as a year away. Because I knew I wanted to come back and study. But I did at least make provisions. I finished my matriculation in Adelaide such that I had a place in a Bachelor of Engineering waiting for me at Adelaide University, just in case I didn't like it. So I did at least follow the academic side through, and this was my plan B. But
was that the influence of your parents or yours?
Well, it was just actually what I'd been studying. I did 2 maths and a physics and then English and German. So the sort of technical side was there. And I always have had a penchant for those sorts of things. And to me, mechanical, electrical or engineering seemed to be a fairly natural way to keep studying if I was going to keep doing the school things. But I got over to Europe and I was in Lucerne, and very soon I was playing as a member of a chamber orchestra, Festival Strings Lucerne, that was, you know, immediately traveling around, not just Europe, but the world, and playing a bit of solo, and I was basically a professional. Although I was only 19, I was earning my own income, and combining that then with the studies, it was a teaching diploma that I was doing there. That's what was offered. This is before the time when everything is standardized to a bachelor, so it was officially a teaching diploma, but it had similar subject spread to what you would get in a bachelor course. So simply combining all of that and pretty well actually enjoying life. I don't think I have thought for a moment about going back and doing the engineering degree. That it only took a couple of weeks and it was forgotten. Yeah, I was having too much fun and learning something. And like I said, this was professional activity already at very early ages. So, you know, standing on the stage and performing at regular intervals, traveling and this was as much a part of my studies as the actual individual lessons. And then discovering repertoire, discovering chamber music. The only thing that really didn't develop during that time in Lucerne was my knowledge of orchestral repertoire, because my contact was with a string orchestra. I was learning individual repertoire and at most playing string quartet or piano trios. So there was still one great big hole in my musical education, and that was orchestras. And I was only about to address that when I finished my studies in Lucerne and found myself as a member of the Karajan Academy, which is the academy that is run by the Berlin Philharmonic. That was when all of a sudden I realized, oh my God, I've got so much stuff to learn, but to discover as well, and how wonderful it all is.
I assume you came to Europe, back to Europe, what, 88, 89. How aware were you of all the other things that were happening around you in Europe? You know, 89 was quite a controversial year in many ways. There were lots of things happening politically all over the place. Were you tucked away from all of that, or were people discussing it? What was the atmosphere like?
I mean, I in Switzerland, I was quite protected, and Switzerland is it has an insular side to especially when you live inside central Switzerland. But nevertheless, there was one, I think in the summer of 89, I was on tour as a soloist playing Brahms Concerto with a Czech orchestra in Switzerland. Mm. And I can remember how they were all glued to their radios. Mm. I mean, because that was the summer when there were basically gaps appearing in the Iron Curtain, where all of a sudden one embassy would say, oh, well, you can get through here today, and people were going through, and there was a bit of a revolution going on also in the Czech Republic where I think, and so things were moving, and yes, I was getting a sense of that. The significance of the wall coming down, it had as much relevance for me as it would for anybody of my age who hadn't perhaps been there and who was not, let's say, particularly politically acute or astute, maybe is the right word. It was happening. It seemed momentous. But I'd say, had I been in Berlin and experienced it firsthand, it would have been very different. Had I grown up in Europe, had I grown up in Germany, had I grown up close to the wall, would have been very different. I mean, I think this is what happens also when you have lived most of your life a long way away, like in Australia, where you read about it, but you can read about everything almost in a theoretical sense. So it's a different thing when you're there and breathing the air and dealing with the people or dealing with things firsthand. Suddenly it goes from theory to practice, and for whatever reason, it always feels different.
Mm. Did you have much contact with your folks? I mean, when I think about it, in this day and age, when I first moved to Europe, I used to have to save up to ring home. You know, it was an expensive thing to be in contact with Australia in those days. These days, of course, it's quite different. But you were a long way from home, and, you know, your parents were busy with other siblings.
It's interesting you ask, because just the other day I found a box with all my correspondence going back right until that time when I moved back over to Europe. And it's, as you say, well, I can remember telephoning was out of the question. It just didn't happen. But there were letters. And what I found the other day were copies of the faxes used to stick in the machine.
Oh, yeah.
And the great joy at being able to write a letter, and instead of waiting the 10 days for it to arrive, let alone the reply and a potential, suddenly you stuck it into this machine, it ate it up, and you knew that it appeared on the other side. And this already felt like a miracle. And how we've moved on since then.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. Yes, trying to explain that to a generation where you can WhatsApp call and things like this is quite something. I agree. We're going to move, of course, to 94. 94 actually was not that long after the fall of the wall. But you came to join the Karajan Academy, and you started to play in the orchestra. You started to play in the Academy Orchestra there to start with. And you moved from being in tertiary education to working with people from within an orchestra. In other words, people, a different type of training in some ways. These people were craftsmen from the orchestra. They knew their job. I'm wondering about the difference of moving from this academic training into really what's considered a breeding ground for orchestra members in many ways. It must have been quite different, their approach. They were probably, did you have to do more orchestral excerpts, or did they train you in a different sort of way?
It was 93, actually, September, when I came and started with the Karajan Academy. And coming to Berlin put me in an environment, because the way the academy works is that You have lessons with the principals in the orchestra. You play with the orchestra as part of your stipend. Sometimes you get paid for it if you do anything above that, and they will also give you instruction on chamber music and things like that. But the environment itself, just sort of listening to the orchestra from the outside, which was still a relatively new experience for me, even just from the outside, let alone sitting on the inside, and watching all the phenomena around me and watching the reactions of people who'd sat in orchestras for 40 years, watching conductors in front of the orchestra who, you know, belong to the best. I mean, I'd heard of these conductors, yeah. And realizing that I didn't have the faintest idea what was going on here. I mean, I would see the conductor do something and I could not see the connection between what the conductor was doing and the way people were reacting. I didn't understand how this worked because it was new. I mean, a body of people simply reacts a little different than you do as an individual. It requires more time. Sometimes it's a little tardier or whatever. But then again, they would sometimes do things together, which I understood didn't know where it came from. They were phrasing, you know, they were modulating notes. They were, and this, of course, this would be the tradition. Maybe this is the way they always. The first time I played a Brahms symphony in the orchestra, I was absolutely perplexed because they were doing all this stuff that wasn't written in the music. They just did it because that's what they always used to do. I guess there's no other way to describe that type of training than learning by doing. Which I think is actually one of the most important learning methods ever. You're just in there and you are surviving and you have a basic set of skills, which means you will hopefully not make such a bad impression and not keep putting your foot in it so as to disturb what's going on. But on the other hand, there's a certain excitement and accompanying anxiety that goes with it as you try and absorb what's going on. And in the end, it's all about experience. It's about being open-minded. It's also about trying to get outside your own worries and just trying to absorb what's around you. I think this is a really, really important factor of playing in an orchestra. It's to listen to what else is going on in what you're doing, and not only, you know, because sometimes if you're worried about something, your tendency will be to narrow the focus down and concentrate incredibly intensely on what you're doing. But the big problem with that when you're in an environment surrounded, an orchestral environment, is that means you've shut everybody else out and you're useless to the collective. So I guess what I was learning is I was becoming socialized as a musician on a large scale. I wasn't used to it in chamber music. I was used to it in a string orchestra. But now this was yet something other again. And then it was basically the beginning of, I would say, a new stage in my education, which really went on long after I then auditioned for the orchestra, got in the orchestra, passed my probationary period. But even then, I would say it took a good 10 years until I had the feeling, okay, now in my particular position, I think I've seen many of the parameters and I'm beginning to understand. And the next stage then of understanding what was going on was, of course, then when I took on the conductor's role myself and realized it isn't as easy as it looks. And that all of my unbridled criticisms of conductors until that date was a little bit unfair. And suddenly finding myself thinking about how do you solve these problems? What's the best thing? And I think one of the great privileges about being a musician, and particularly for myself living here in Berlin with my roles as a player but also as a conductor, is it's an ongoing process of education, basically. Mm. I mean, any piece that you've done 10 years ago, you'll come and do it again. It feels different because of what's happened in the 10 years before. Any piece you played 100 times as a player in the orchestra, you come conductor the first time, it's still a new piece because you're hearing and reacting and your responsibilities are different. The fortunate thing really is actually to be able to experience this phenomena of orchestra playing and repertoire from both sides. And I think if I look back on my life, how it started with violin and it went to string ensemble and now it's landed with the orchestra and it's settled very, very firmly in the orchestra environment, I think I could safely say that I live now for orchestras.
Being in one of the world's finest ensembles, you encounter many of the great musicians around the place, conductors, composers, the lot. Did you ever just wake up one day and you think, okay, well, tonight we've got a concert, you know, Abbado's conducting and maybe the soloist is Marta Agaric or something like this. And you just sort of think, am I, you know, slightly overwhelmed by that sometimes?
I think the word overwhelming is absolutely dead right. It was overwhelming. As I said, when I got into it at the beginning, I was also very inexperienced and I felt not only overwhelmed, but I felt quite inadequate as well. And so that was, you know, part of the catching up I felt I personally had to do. But it's also interesting from another point of view, because I grew up every morning at whenever the alarm clock went off in the morning, 6 or 6.30, and we had it tuned to ABC FM. And so we would hear the news and then we would hear music until we managed to get out of bed. and I can still remember all the names that I used to hear. I mean, there was a lot of St. Martin's Academy in the Fields, there were Mariner, but there were various names that kept cropping up, whatever it used to be the standard playlist back then. And then to find myself in an environment where suddenly these people who I knew as abstract things that came out of a radio, these were now people. And I think that was also another thing, was to observe these people as people, you know. I mean, you listen to them on recordings. A recording is, in the end, it's a static document of one particular, you know, go at the work, edited or not edited, whatever. But when you have the real human beings there, you know, you can see that human beings, they have their, you know, there's sometimes this effort, sometimes it's not that it's not perfect, and it's not that I was encouraged by the fact that, you know, they are mere mortals, because some of them still were doing incredible things. But you realize that in the end, that being the human being in this situation is that which is common to us all. And you can, I mean, you can be, you can feel completely intimidated by that, or you can find it encouraging as well. And I think I certainly found it encouraging. I mean, it was very often a great incentive to go back and try things, because you see that there are, to any given problem, there are any number of solutions. And what's so inspiring is to be in the presence of people who have obviously thought about this much, much more than I have, or worked on it much more seriously than I have. And at least you can just follow a little bit in that direction in trying to develop and improve yourself. I mean, this is, I think that's the positive side of that environment. Once you get over the overwhelmed side and the feeling of being completely intimidated by all this potency and talent.
Mm. Quite something. Tell us about Abbado and the things that he was particularly good at. I mean, you know, I have the great honor, I find it in many ways, of talking to musicians from different orchestras. And the Israeli Philharmonic, for example, it doesn't matter who you ask in that orchestra, they'll always say for them one of the most important things was Bernstein and Mahler, for example. And is there a sort of a thing that you, when you think about Abbado, that you can sort of connect with him straight away, and the thing that he did maybe the best?
Well, interestingly, I think it's Mahler as well.
Right. Oh, wow.
I think that was one of his really great fortes. I mean, in some ways, I think he brought Mahler into the center of our repertoire more so. I think Karajan was very careful with Mahler. I think he waited a long time before he addressed it. And there was with us also one, I wasn't there, but there was a Bernstein experience with Mahler 9, which my older colleagues also said was the most memorable experience of their life. I would have loved to have experienced him. Yeah. But he wasn't frequently in Berlin. There was, I don't know if Karajan was so keen that such a charismatic person should perhaps come too often. I don't know. But certainly Abbado and Mahler, that's something I will never forget. I mean, I did a lot of this repertoire. Coming to Berlin, not being experienced in orchestral playing, I did a lot of things for the first time with Abbado. So, for example, I did all the Brahms symphonies with him for the first time. Did a lot of the Beethoven symphonies with him for the first time. And they were good. They were really good. And they formed, no doubt, they're sort of like, that's the corner of the universe from which I started my journey with these works. I mean, I may have come a long way since then. And look back on it and say, well, I wouldn't do it like that anymore, or I don't agree with that anymore. But certainly, I don't know. I just think I was fortunate because they ended up being my mother's milk with these pieces. It's very nice to start with these works at that level and not fight your way up from another place.
Yeah.
I felt very inspired by him when he conducted. I felt he was beautiful to watch. And after a while, I did understand how to play with him, or how to incorporate what he was doing. It was a very indistinct way of conducting sometimes, where it wasn't certainly not It wasn't something where you try and play with the beat. He would suggest much more phrases. He would get incredibly far ahead of the orchestra. I mean, he could often be, you know, several beats in front of the orchestra if you were to analyze where his movements were. And yet, when you were playing, it didn't really seem to matter. This was a particular skill that he had of sort of like someone who runs ahead of the group just to show you where it's going to go, but you don't feel like you've got to run too. You're just trotting along with the herd. He's gone ahead and pointed something out to you, and you can incorporate that when you then pass that moment. That's the way I saw the way he did things. Other people would have just said, could you please give us a clear beat? Because they, you know what I mean? It just does, that sort of thing doesn't appeal to everybody. And when I'm sitting, again, if I talk about a herd, I'm sitting inside a group. That's okay. I have the, you know, I have the certain security through being part of a mass. But I do understand now also from a conductor's point of view that if you're a wind player and you're playing a particularly dangerous part or that sort of thing can just be really upsetting because, you know, it's really hard what you're trying to do. You're trying to pick a very specific moment and someone out the front is drawing a phrase which is happening in the next bar. That's not helping you very much. And you're not sure if what you hear in that moment is exactly what it is. And you'd be really grateful if he could help you here. So, you know, I had seen now how for some, and I understand why there was certainly some great criticism of him and his conducting style from some colleagues who just found it way too unclear and made their life too dangerous and it made them feel very uncomfortable. And there was certainly a large fraction also of old Currierites who basically found everything weak. He would tend to be a lot more flexible. He would be very flexible with his tempos. His phrases really breathed, and I think for some people that went a little bit against a steadier flow, which may have been something that Curran was very good at establishing. He went about also, I think, fracturing the sound a little bit in that he did ask for beautiful sound. Abado himself was trained in Vienna, and the whole sound aesthetic thing, I think he took from there. And nevertheless, though, he was, you know, he would go for the harsher colors sometimes and try and incorporate them in his aesthetic rather than have to place such great emphasis on homogeneity as perhaps Currierite might have done. I can only really say this judging from things that I know. You know, it's I feel a little wrong passing judgment on it. I can only say that's what Abado did, which then Simon Rattle, when he came, took to another level altogether. I think for Simon, the whole idea of homogeneity only had specific musical relevance at certain moments, but was certainly not something to be made a central aesthetic or central factor to music making in general. And so he was very much about trying to highlight the panoply of colours which exists in an orchestra. I mean, you can do two things with an orchestra. What you can do, you can try and focus the sound towards a common taste. In other words, try and unify it as much as you can. Or you can celebrate also some of the diversity in the orchestra of there being softer sounds, brighter sounds, harsher sounds, more direct sounds, more indirect sounds, harder fronts to the notes, softer notes. And you can make that a central focus, the fact that an orchestra is indeed an incredible palette of colours. And this is one of the jobs of a conductor, and this is one of the things a conductor can have an influence on an orchestra, is influencing that taste in a certain direction. I think one thing is that when you work with orchestras here, like Berlin and in Vienna and maybe other orchestras too, they certainly, we come, and this is the tradition part of things, we come with a certain aesthetic of our own. You know, this is, it starts when we listen to auditions, the sorts of things we're listening for. And where it's not going to work then is if your aesthetic is so far removed from, let's say, a couple of central points that exist within the orchestra, then it's not going to work. And that's a relationship which is maybe doomed over time. But a certain amount of friction is always necessary.
You're now well into, well, shall we say, moving into the Petranko period. And you quite rightly corrected me in the salon when I said that the Berlin Philharmonic didn't play opera. And of course you do. And of course Petranko is really very well known as an opera conductor. What? How do you feel that? How do you sense that within the orchestra? Is there something that you could sort of sense there that you can say, oh yeah, I'm getting something here. This orchestra plays, we're going to play perhaps a little bit differently because of this.
We already do play differently. I mean, if I just listen a little bit to what we've done with him, and it has, still hasn't been so much. He's really just getting started now in January 20. This is his work in the Bavarian State Opera is now tailing off, and he, for example, now in January he'll do two programs, and he did the New Year's Eve concert as well. So within the space of 1 month, it'll be three programs. This is more than he's ever done with us so far. But nevertheless, the few times he's been here now, I can already feel the orchestra plays differently. And yes, it's bound up with the way he conducts, the physicality of the way he conducts, his movements, the energy he uses when he conducts. I mean, you know, there are many subconscious influences a conductor can have on an orchestra, and the physicality of how they conduct has an influence. If someone has very powerful, punchy gestures, I think you're going to hear that. And if someone is only flowing, and you're going to hear it maybe also smear around the edges a little bit. I mean, everything has a role, but they're so subtle. It's a bit like comparing, I don't know, the taste of the same wine over different years. I mean, you can get it horribly wrong with your theories. So I warn myself against being too... cocksure about my judgments, but nevertheless there is a difference, and I find the orchestra is playing incredibly well together. There is a real sense of common purpose I'm experiencing at the moment, which is certainly bound up with the initial period where everyone's still very excited about it all. We play much closer to his beat than I've ever experienced with this orchestra, and this orchestra's usually resisted attempts by conductors to move it closer to the beat. But he's got a way of making it happen so that it still feels right. I'm still to get behind exactly how that works. And he demands a high degree of... I don't want to use precision or accuracy because that's too dry, but he hears very, very clearly. And the things that, once pointed out, we hear too. Mm. And suddenly you're not happy with anything less. So shall we call it quality or... demanding? I don't know. He just...
awareness.
Cleans out the earwax a little bit, maybe. Yeah. So there's that side of it. There's also, I think, you know, in an orchestra like this where you have an unbelievable group of dynamic personalities, you know, all the principal players are world-class soloists in their own right with a ton of things to say. And yet when you play together in an orchestra, somehow you have to find a coherence. And yet you don't want to tread on these beautiful, organisms. You know, you don't want to kill them so that you get unity. I've never conducted the Berlin Phil, but I think that must be one of the hardest things to do is how can you activate all of that potential and not kill it and yet still get it to unify in its sense of direction. And I have this feeling that this is something Petrenko is quite good at. Mm. He's quite good at winning people over to his way of doing things. Or, like I said, you hear it with his ears and you suddenly realize, oh, well, yeah, he's actually right. We should, you know, be a comment he made in the rehearsal. But, yeah, maybe. And so that's what I've been struck by, is that there is this sort of unity of purpose in our orchestra, which, I don't know, I find it really, really exciting. You know, it's not about each individual trying to outplay the other. There'll always be a bit of that. And that's part of what makes this orchestra, I think, really special. But it's being moulded. Already now, I feel like there's a certain moulding process going in. And I find it very enjoyable to play because in the end, you know, I have a highly developed set of skills and I'm actually quite grateful when someone demands of me that I use them rather than just get away with. I mean, I think the first ingredient of frustration is the feeling it doesn't matter anyway, because that's the beginning of a slippery slope that leads down to callousness and a very, very low feeling of self-esteem. Yeah, and the thing is, it does matter, and suddenly you realize, oh, we can do all of this stuff.
Your move to conducting also started with Abbado, though, didn't it, as well? You got the position, and you started to play, and then basically something changed. Your needs changed, and you moved towards conducting. When did you realize that conducting was something you wanted to spend more time doing?
Well, I realized very early after I got the job as a second violinist, in a Tutti second violinist, that whilst there were many challenges that I faced in that job, some of the best ways to address the challenges that I had in front of me was to pursue my own individual goals as a violinist still. In other words, I needed more than just playing in the orchestra. And so for the first 10 years, actually, it was string quartet playing that fulfilled that function for me. So within the string quartet environment, with some very, very trusted and treasured friends, I must say, we pursued string quartet playing very seriously. And that gave me that room for individual expression and experimentation in the questions of interpretations that I felt I needed and which I wasn't going to get only from the orchestral environment. But it was actually, and then the conducting came about almost a bit by chance, because, and again, it was I think I said this, it was Brett Dean who invited me out to Australia. So my conducting career really began in Australia at Australian Music Camp, where he invited me as camp director to work with a string orchestra called the...
Yeah, both you and I know who Brett Dean is. Brett Dean is a former member of the Orchestra Viola Player and, of course, today, one of today's most sought-after composers. And this was when? What, middle of the 90s or something? Or?
No, this is, I think, 2001.
Okay.
And so Brett was still a member of the orchestra at that time, if I'm not mistaken. And so I was out in Australia. I had this large string orchestra to look after at Australian Music Camp, and I thought that meant I would select the repertoire, I'd do the rehearsals with them, and I would train them to play independent of me, so an unconducted, which is quite not uncommon for string orchestras. But the repertoire was quite complicated, and then when I arrived in Australia, Brett said, no, I don't think that's going to work. I think you're going to have to conduct it. So... without much forewarnings, from one day to the next, I think there's no better way to start something, because who can expect anything of you then, you know? It's the freest, most freest environment you can to try anything out is without being told it until the time it is that you have to do it. And so I had 2 weeks of that, and I had a really, really wonderful time. And at the end of it, there were several people who were encouraging me to take it more seriously. First of all, Brett Dean was encouraging me. I'd also met John Currow. Mm-hmm. From Queensland, who'd recently passed away, and I'd watched his work and realised, oh, there's a lot to this, actually.
The former conductor of the Queensland Youth Orchestra, and of course the initiator of the careers of many people, the inspiration of the musical careers of many people along the way. Yes, John Currow in Queensland. Yeah,
that's right. So, I mean, I got words of encouragement, and so when I returned to Berlin, I set about trying to work out how I could pursue this, because the thing about learning conducting is you need an orchestra. Conducting is a horrible thing to study because you can't buy an orchestra and practice on it. You need an orchestra. You, of course, there's many things you can learn a little bit in theory. You can learn plenty of things in class and talk about it, but I talked earlier about the value of learning by doing. Well, I think this is certainly, conducting is one of those things. You need to learn it by conducting, and then it's a little bit like getting your pilot's license. I think you need simply to do 10,000 hours, and then maybe you can say you have an understanding of what's going on. Doesn't mean you're necessarily a good conductor, but at least you've seen a lot of the situations you can be confronted with. So I was fortunate. When I got back to Berlin, I actually found not just one, but two community orchestras that were looking for a conductor. And these are amateur orchestras made up of great variety of people. I mean, from students to professionals. And a number of them had pursued musical studies even at tertiary level. They'd done like parallel law and music, and then at some point made the very sensible decision to become a lawyer and keep music as their hobby. But at a high level. So together with these orchestras, I had the opportunity at least once a week to stand in front of them and conduct. And I began to do repertoire, because that's the next thing. You have to really start learning. You have to do as many pieces as you can. And with two orchestras, I had a chance to do 4 programs a year. And that was, let's say, that formed a very important staple for my initial years as a conductor before it then turned towards professional ensembles, beginning with some ensembles of members of the Berlin Philharmonic. I would work also with the Carrion Academy, of which I myself was a graduate. And then there were some invitations in Australia. I mean, Melbourne was very good and invited me quite early, in Tasmania. Canberra I enjoyed going back to very often. And then there were orchestras also here in Europe and then some in Asia. And so it was a mixture of experiences. I got involved with youth orchestras as well because I realized this is something I can, you know, having learned everything in some ways the hard way, I realized I had a fairly good foundation for pedagogical work because I, from my work with amateurs and or with youth, I have sort of I'm awareness for every problem that can arise with an orchestra. So, and I have some solutions for them. So it worked. I realized that was something I'm very good at too. And this continued until really relatively recently in 2004, or beginning of the 2010s, I began doing some appearances as a guest conductor with the Berlin Symphony Orchestra, or Symphony Orchester Berlin, as it's known in German. And then from 2014, I was officially appointed their principal conductor. And now I do 10 concerts a year with them and in the Philharmonie. And the concerts are sold out. This is a concert series which has existed for over 60 years and it's very popular here. And so that's my good fortune.
You mentioned there, you know, as far as training goes, many, many years ago, I met Igor Ozim when he was about to retire, a very famous violin teacher. And he said something that I'm sure a lot of people have said in the meantime or before that as well. But he did say that he found that people were playing much better these days, technically, that musicians were better trained. But he said something very interesting. He said, there's still only that same amount of special talent. He said, you know, you'll find people playing technically more proficient, but that special extra was just as rare as it always was. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think we're certainly that the level of playing is going up and up and up. I hear that at every audition I attend. I mean, the level is certainly very high. But I would actually focus a little bit more and ask myself, what is that special something? And yes, there is that what you call X factor or personality or charisma. That is special, particularly if you want to make a mark as a soloist. But, you know, there are many other roles for an instrumentalist, and particularly a lot of instruments find their principal calling in an orchestra. I mean, let's just take the wind instruments, for example. A lot of the greatest repertoire for these instruments is as a member of an orchestra. And the same goes for string players as well. And that special something, I think actually what it is, it's an interest that goes beyond just the violin playing. Because what I would say in reply to Igor Ozim is that in the end, the violin repertoire still consists of the same pieces over and over again. I mean, there's only one instrument which has, let's say, a universe of repertoire unto itself, and that's piano. Mm. The violin comes then second, but a fairly distant second. And
it's not too bad.
It's okay, but I mean, it dwindles very quickly once you move on past cello to viola and then, you know, the wind instruments. Everybody, you know, if you want to become a soloist in those areas. And I think what makes, for me, the interesting musician is someone who goes beyond their own instruments and looks into the world or the universe of music. So it will include the piano repertoire, but it will, and it took me a long time to get there, but it will include the symphonic repertoire. And then all of the chamber music. Now, if this is your world, if this is your universe, then there's no doubt in my mind, if you're just by nature interested and you wish to partake of it, you will be the more, in some ways, the more interesting musician simply because your universe is bigger. Mm. I think if it is limited just to the violin, one is going to sense that, particularly if one's not a violinist. I mean, the violinists all go gaga, but maybe everybody else goes, okay, but what? I don't know. That would be a little bit my how I would rephrase what Ozim said. Yes, of course, special talent, the amazing performer, that personality where everybody in the hall just smiles, that remains as rare as ever. Mm. But I think one thing any musician can do, if you love music, my advice to you would be go and listen to lots of music. Go and listen to a lot of music for instruments other than your own. Always just listen to stuff. Go. I think in the end, that's the great fortune we have because the world is a huge and colourful place in music. And you can do a lot of carbon neutral traveling just by listening to music from all different cultures around the world as well.
What about you? How did you change when you went back? You've become a conductor. Did you get more sympathetic to the conductor?
I learned to reserve judgment and not be so hasty. And I mean, for me, of course, I see the conductor and I can observe many, many things in the way they work. I can see, for it begins in the rehearsals, how are they using their time? What do they focus on? I'm aware of many difficulties and so usually the fascination is simply to see how they deal with it, how they deal with it with this particular orchestra too. Because, again, I've conducted many orchestras, but I haven't conducted the Berlin Phil. And just to see where they place their priorities, how they go about doing. Of course, you can always watch how they conduct and pick up one or the other, I don't know, little things. But that's quite a dead end. If you just try and imitate another conductor physically, that you don't get very far. And that's something I've tried to not do. The only thing I notice is if you do watch one conductor for a long time without even realizing it, you begin to emulate it. You can't help that. But like I said, the most interesting thing is simply to watch how they use their time, how they develop, what emphasis they place, and then, of course, to see what they do in the concert. I mean, I know the pieces well. I can see where their attention is. I can see when they're conducting from memory also, if they've looked at something after it happened rather than before. In other words, I know a lot of the phenomena of what it's like to be on stage, and I know how complex it is. I know how you've got a million things you could focus on. You're in rehearsal, you've got 100 things you could say, and how do you know at that moment not to say anything or to say just that one thing? And how far do you go and when do you stop? I mean, this is the most acute time management you'll ever have to do in your life, is how to structure a rehearsal, for example.
Speaking of time management, you've established yourself here, and you've made your home here in Berlin. You're married to a woman from Queensland, a cellist, Rowena, and of course, three grown-up children here, and in various capacities, being busy as the father, being busy at the orchestra, doing more than just playing, of course. You're also involved in the administration there and various aspects of that as well.
When I'm involved in administration, I'm also involved in the running of the hall, and this is also the hall in which I am a chief conductor of another orchestra, which plays solely in this hall. They're not immediately connected, but I'm illustrating how everything basically happens, not just in Berlin for me, but in the Berlin Philharmonie. And so everything else is simply a matter of being well organized and a certain reliance on myself that I can work quickly. The danger is always superficiality. Sometimes I do think I would like to perhaps reduce the variety of what I do to focus, and I would say here more specifically on conducting, so as to perhaps go deeper, go further, or make it my sole focus. Because I find that the activity of conducting itself offers a diverse range of challenges, because the conducting is the one thing, but there's a lot of managerial work in conducting, even if you're not part of administration, because there's rehearsal structures, there's dates planning, there's planning programs for the whole season. There's many artistic components to it, which also take up a lot of your time. So conducting is really worthy of a full-time job. And that's the one development I could still envision in my life, looking ahead, is that maybe there'll be an orchestra out there which I get to know and they get to know me, and we have the feeling, yes, maybe the next 5 years will be something for both of us, and I can bring my experience to them, and together we can make a mark. I think that's, and for that I would consider leaving my job in the orchestra as a player and focusing solely on conducting. But that is, it's like a dream. It's something that might happen. It's something that might not happen. And in the meantime, I'm enjoying very much what it is that I have to do here.
What about looking back to Australia and the relationship you have with Australia these days? You've got both your parents there. You've got two siblings living there. How involved are you? How up to date do you stay with what's happening back home? I mean, we talked about it before. It used to be faxes and, you know, okay, scrambling for a newspaper here or there to find out bits and pieces. How do you feel about Australia these days?
Well, I'm always, every time I check my email, I'm hoping there'll be an invitation to come and do something out there. it doesn't happen that often, but I have fairly regular contact with my parents, not so much. They manage to make it over to Europe once a year, so I see them for 2 or 3 weeks here where they attend as many concerts as they can. You know, I have subscriptions to various newspapers, and I've got the ABC as a bookmark on my browser. So yes, I am, as much as I can, keeping an eye on the world from the Australian point of view. But it isn't. It isn't the way I see the world at all. I mean, I am very much here in Germany, and I think my outlook on the world is probably now much more from a German perspective than an Australian perspective. The connection I feel and the bond I feel to Australia is on a somehow deeply emotional level, and I'm removed from day-to-day life in Australia quite thoroughly, actually. The fondest memories I have of Australia are being somewhere in an isolated spot, sensing the wilderness and sensing, actually, in many ways, what I consider to be a harsh environment, which is always gives you a little bit that sense of your real place in the universe, and it gives you a sense of modesty. It's a wonderful way to feel existence, I find, in those remoter parts of Australia. And then there is a beauty which I consider to be raw and which appeals to me. I realize it's something that I've absorbed and it's a part of me as well.
We talked about it in the salon, and it might be nice to talk about it again a little bit now. You are, of course, of mixed heritage. Your mum was Chinese, your dad Irish background. You grew up in Australia. How was that?
I think at the time I was growing up, there was a lot less diversity than it became. I mean, this is the 70s, and beginning in the 90s particularly, I think there was a move towards much greater Asian diversity, certainly. And until then, there had, of course, Australia's always had its waves of immigrants from Southern Europe, Greece, Italy. I think in the 80s, it was very much the Vietnamese who were the refugees of the time. So, I mean, Australia's always been multicultural from that point of view. But nevertheless, I would have said in the 70s, it still felt like my memories of it are white Anglo-Saxon, to be honest. And that's very much the environment I grew up in. And that's the Australia I also, I guess, still remember. So some of the developments in Australia have passed me by in that respect. And I can be quite struck sometimes when walking around parts of Australian city centres how not only diverse, but just how I'm ashamed to say how foreign it all, yeah, it seems, in that there are obviously people, many, many people who have heritages outside that white Anglo sphere. I mean, in some ways I welcome it. It's fantastic, but it's not the Australia I grew up in, if I'm honest, I think.
Mm. How at home do you feel here?
In Berlin, I feel very at home, because I think Berlin is a little atypical for Germany in that it is very cosmopolitan. It's very diverse in many aspects, economically, socially, heritage-wise. It's a large city, and it has a sort of live and let live atmosphere about it. I mean, you can be anybody, you can be any weirdo you want to be here, but it's somehow no one will turn their head. I sometimes think that maybe, and this is said with a not great amount of knowledge about the United States, but I think sometimes Berlin is to Germany what New York is to the United States. There's sort of a slight, they are a microcosm of their own that don't quite conform to national stereotypes. So you really get everything here, and I must say I feel absolutely at home here. Mm. I mean, I appreciate that very much, and it's a very mixed bag. I mean, the primary, immigrant culture here will be the Turkish Arab, I suppose you would say, versus in Australia, perhaps the Asian component at the moment. But, you know, all of it is... what I like is that you can go to a different part of Berlin and experience something completely different. You can even experience different times in history. You can still go to a part of Berlin and feel like you're in the GDR. So I rather like that there are all sorts of time capsules in this city.
What about here? I mentioned before, you're two Australians with three children. How important a role has Australia played in the lives of the kids, for example?
Very different, actually. I mean, I think that all three of them, well, they all carry Australian passports because of the naturalisation laws here. They'd have to give it up if they want to become German, and they don't want to give it up, which is something I understand, because they feel an emotional attachment to the country through their parents. They went to a German-American school, and I mean, they were Australians in a cosmopolitan environment where being Australian was the exotic component. And we observed simply how all three kids developed very different groups of friends. One of them oriented more towards German speaking, or let's say divided it quite evenly. Another son had more English speaking friends because, like himself, a guy from England or from South Africa or from America. And the daughter moved in the direction of music, which has now taken her to just a German-speaking school. But that was something that surprised us a little bit, was in this bilingual environment, how what you can't influence as a parent is exactly to what degree their own personal emphasis will become in the different languages, and hence also the different cultures. Mm-hmm. I think as it's turned out for them, certainly for my two sons, and even the son who really positioned himself in the middle of both, English is certainly still their dominant culture, but being the language being the language spoken at home, it's the language where they feel probably the most able to express themselves, and yet they're absolutely fluent in both languages. And I think as far as their relationship to Australia is concerned, I have one son who's now returned to Australia and is studying at University of Queensland, and I would say he has an idea of what Australia is like, but the other two will remember Australia only as that country of holidays, of grandparents, and of the sorts of things you only do when you're on holiday. In other words, the real life, the ups and downs, and particularly the downs, and they have no experience of that. And it's the second son I find who is probably now the most genuine Australian, perhaps even of all of us. I mean, he's up to date. I'm not.
How represented do you feel as an Australian artist outside of Australia?
I don't find that it makes that much. I don't think that's my main descriptive characteristic here, for example. I mean, as a musician in Berlin, certainly if there's like an article or an interview, they almost will always associate me with my institution, Berlin Philharmonic, and not so where I come from. I mean, that will find some. Unfortunately, my biography is a little muddied because although I'm Australian, I was born in Canada. So sometimes it ends up turning out that people describe me as Canadian because I was born but moved immediately away from Canada and I'm no longer a Canadian citizen. But so somehow the whole, I don't know, I think people look at me with my mixed heritage anyway and think, well, that just looks too complicated. We'll move on.
I can understand that. Really. I have two sentences I'd like you to finish. The first one is, I know I'm an Australian when.
Sorry, I'm thinking so long. I can't. It's because I have to really. Yeah, I know I'm Australian when I hear another Australian, and I hear the accent, the rhythm, the melody, the sounds, and there's something inside me that just relaxes. And it's like I can take a barrier down, and it's that feeling of being at home. And I find it in the way the language sounds. I know that's a little indirect, but I know I'm Australian when I'm in Australia, and I look out onto a eucalypt forest with its greys and browns, and that sense of wilderness, but also melancholy of the eucalypt forest, which I absolutely love. It's not bright, gaudy rainbow colours. They're muted greys and greens, and there's a smell that goes with it, and there are sounds which go with it, and it's like the language. I feel attached. And they're the sorts of things that I remember too.
Nice. I think you probably answered my next question, but because I was going to ask you, when I think of Australia, I think of...
Well, a horribly long flight. That's
yeah, that's true.
I've been an expat for too long,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, 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 I know this.
Yeah. Oh, actually, well, I mean, what I really think of, I mean, it's blinding light, actually. That's one thing I notice when I go to Australia is there's more light in Australia at any time of year. The other thing that's also in Australia that I only know from there is the depth of the blue sky when it's blue sky. I've always thought, is it the southern hemisphere or why is it? But I don't know that colour of sky anywhere else.
Stan, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time and for talking to me today and for coming on the podcast. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much, Brendan.
Musician Stan Dodds speaking to me there. If you enjoyed this podcast, then please do share it via social media or by emailing the link. And don't forget to visit our website for more information about what I do, tool-poppies.com, or drop me an email to info@tool-poppies.com. It's been nice to have you with me today. Till next time, this is Brendan O'Shea saying goodbye from Berlin.